Okay, well, most of the people in this room know who I am. I thought I would, my name is Deanna Lagerquist. I teach at St. Helens College. And this session is even more ridiculous than Kit Nagel trying to do the history of China. Because instead of talking about the history of China in 1 hour, I want to say something about the history of the Christian church always and everywhere. Now, I used to teach a course at St. Olaf that was a kind of standard survey, which I called, on the syllabus I would write, History of the Christian Church, Now and Then, Here and There. And I figured out, you know, it was like 3 minutes per year. And, so that's okay, because 7 years is not very much happening. But part of what is of interest to me in this session, and as I look at the third of my career, is all the places in which Christianity has taken root that I never really paid attention to. In part, that is precisely because of my opportunity to take St. Olaf students abroad. So the first time I went to Greece and Turkey, and I was in Istanbul, I thought, my goodness, I have 3 history degrees from church-related institutions, and I really don't have a clue what's going on here. You know, and I had at my doctoral advisory stuff in this party where at Christmas the game favors would be books, because he was a book review editor for the Christian Century. And once I had gotten this book on the Theodosian Empresses, and just that fall I had sold it to half price books, probably for a quarter. And then I wanted to understand about the Theodosian princesses, empresses, and the way in which the politics of the Byzantine Empire contributed to the development of the Trinitarian Christological settlements, and the interplay of political and family dynamics. It just opened up this world that I had really not paid any attention to. So what I want to do today is broad sweep to describe some things about where we are, how we have gotten to be in a place where I think it is accurate to say that Christianity is global. But, and you could do that both in a sort of narrative description and with some analysis, and then to give you some specific examples of manifestations of the church around the world, particularly toward this question: what difference does this make to Christians in the United States? What difference does it make to the reign of God that we know more than I knew, 7 years ago, about Christians who aren't in the United States or in Europe? I was going to say something else about it, but I forgot what it was. Okay, so I thought maybe I'm going to pose to you 3 questions. I'm not going to write up your answers on the board, but just to kind of have these in mind. One would be, can you identify positive contributions that American Christians have made to Christianity? Right? Does anything come to your mind? I know we're all really good at saying the things that are bad about the American church. But are there some positive contributions that American Christians have made to the witness of the church?
Okay. That are distinct. I think of the spirituals.
Absolutely. That would be, I think, one of the first ones we would think of. The tradition of African-American spirituals.
To the extent that America could own it, this concept of separation of church and state from European.
I think that's also a very, very important one. So that, if I'm going to do a fast run through the history of Christianity, and one of the things I'll come to is the American Constitution and the First Amendment. And the way that Americans think about the relationship between the institution of the church, which is what they were thinking about when they wrote the Constitution. They weren't thinking generally about other religions. They were thinking about Christianity and the church and government. And we have a very peculiar understanding of that. The idea that you can both, that the government would guarantee free exercise, that whatever religion you are free to exercise it, and that nobody gets any special treatment. And then another part that we don't often think about is that it's not the responsibility of any religious group to hold up the government and give it credibility, right? That changed something that had been in place for about 1,400 years for Christianity. So that's incredibly important to how American Christians look at Christianity in other times and in other places, and how we interact with people of other faiths. It's really important. Another question I would ask you, and any one of these we could spend a semester on, so this is just to kind of get your brain going. What do American Christians have in common with Christians of other times and other places? This isn't a trick question.
Jesus Christ.
Creed. Sort of. Some. Most, right? But when I, Chris,
the gospel?
This, the gospel, the Bible, the creeds,
sacraments.
On all of those, we could find marginal places where it's not exactly the same, right? Quakers don't have quite the same understanding of sacraments that Lutherans and Anglicans and Roman Catholics do. Anyone who's had a first-year Bible class in the last 15 or 20 years has confronted the fact that the canon is different if you're Roman Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox. Mm-hmm. Right? And one of the major splits in Christianity early on was precisely about what we now call the ecumenical creeds. Right? Ecumenical suggesting that we would all hold these in common. Right? That we would all agree to these. And yet, there are significant populations of Christians then and now who have a slightly different relationship to what's stated in those creeds. Remembering that creeds are usually, not always, but usually the answers to debated questions, right? So when you confess a creed, in a way, you're taking a side in an argument that you're not a part of. And that's why it's so hard for us to get our brain around it, because somebody really cared about this one. They cared about it so much. And then they came to this agreement about the answer, and we're just stand up there and recite it without really knowing what the question was. Okay. But we do have these things in common. I guess the third thing I would ask is what American Christians have received from Christians of other times and places, but that's really the point of all of this, so I'm not gonna stop and take time for that. I know there are people in this room who have rich and sustained relationships with Christians in other places, and some of us with Christians who have long been dead, so of other times. So I say right up front, as a caveat, I'm trying to do a lot really fast, and what I'm trying to do here is begin to move from being a novice to one who understands not just details, but how the details go together in patterns. We find that when I'm trying to teach. Sometimes I know lots and lots of details, but I haven't a clue what the pattern is. I'm sure every student has been in a lecture like that where you're thinking, could you tell me why this matters? And so I'm trying to do a little of each thing here as I'm figuring it out myself. So if you're confused, it's probably because I'm confused, and stop me, and we'll try and figure it out together. Okay. So the first thing would be to say, what makes Christianity global? Well, here's some, these aren't the most up-to-date figures, they're from the 1990s, but they give you the point that Christianity is all around the world. There are a significant number of Christians in each of these areas. Currently, about 20% of Christians live in Europe and North America, and 80% are everywhere else. Some people predict that by 2025, 50% will be in Africa and Asia. So, at the simple descriptive level, Christians are all the way around the globe, so Christianity must be global, right? I think it probably has more When we say Christianity is global, it's more than a matter of geographical spread. To use the word global is to evoke a 20th century phenomenon that we talk about, globalization and drinking Coca-Cola in Korea or Starbucks in, you know, more Starbucks in China than in the US. We have that kind of idea in mind, that globalization is related to the phenomena of imperialization and colonization. And of course that's true. How it's related is a changing and interesting question. So when we read the book of Acts, and the evangelist tells us that the church is going to move from Jerusalem to Judea to the ends of the earth, probably what they have in mind is the Roman Empire, which is built on the Greek Empire, which really has to do with Alexander the Great, right? So for Christianity to spread initially, there was a kind of political, cultural, commercial world that constituted not the globe, because they weren't having a globe to think about that, but it constituted the whole world. And when we think about the church as globalized, we can't ignore those political, financial, cultural factors. Although today they might not come up a lot because we're trying to do really a lot in a really short time. Okay. There's also the claim of the creed that the church is one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. And in that theological claim, Catholic means kind of whole, everywhere. The church is one big thing, right? And it's unified. Now, we know that's an aspiration more than a reality. But we do see this, and we hear in that the relationship between its origins with the apostles and the notion that it would be everywhere. The historian's question is always about continuity and change over time. So do we mean the same thing when we say the church is global now as the book of Acts meant? Yes and no, I would say. And let me just say something about that, this kind of narrative. The way I learned this story, and those of you who had a History of Christianity course, if you read Williston Walker, we saw this in a certain way. Now, I went back and looked at one of the old standard History of Christianity texts that we have in the library here, and it actually was better than I would have thought. It said more than I remembered. But there's a kind of way we tell this story that goes kind of like this. Well, there was Jesus. And then there was the New Testament period that lasts till about 100. And during that time, the church spread out from Jerusalem to Judea to the ends of the earth, which means to Rome. Right? And the first European convert was who? Christa, the first European convert, who was baptized in a river where I gave you a piece of chocolate, was...
No pressure.
Lydia. But we kind of follow this through the New Testament. And that ends, so about 100. And then we have the apostolic era, and then the patristic era. And so we're thinking of Christianity kind of as a Mediterranean phenomenon, maybe. And then we come to this really important date. Yes, 312. I used to give my students Milano cookies when we came to this because it's the Edict of Milan, but apparently food isn't that good for helping us remember. She already graduated, so I know, you know, it's a whole new relationship.
So is the first European convert Lydia?
Yeah. Although she was really from Asia Minor, so it's sort of slippery, but it happened in Europe. It happened in Macedonia, in northern Greece. Mm-hmm. So that's why she gets called the first European convert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think also useful
talk about globalization just to reflect on the fact that Mediterranean means center of the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, as does the Chinese name for themselves. Right? And then there's the center of the earth that's in Delphi. And then there's the center of the earth that's in Istanbul. You know, you go lots of places that people think, and that's partly what I'm saying here, is to show how historians of Christianity have tended to move our focus. This isn't a very good Mediterranean, but, you know, so here's Christianity. And then 312 is when the Emperor Constantine decriminalizes Christianity. And I put it that way because it's not like Christianity is suddenly established. It takes a while for that to actually happen. But Christianity is decriminalized, and then over the next two centuries, the alliance between Christianity and imperial political power, with that comes cultural influence, becomes very, very tight. So for Christianity to be globalized before 312 is to be globalized as if not a criminal, at least a marginal group. They can't own buildings, for example. After 312, that begins to shift. And that leads not just to being able to build buildings, but that alliance, contrary to what I said about the United States, is such that one of the responsibilities of Christianity is to help shore up the credibility of the imperial system. Now, I'm way oversimplifying this. That puts pressure on the church to get its act together. So prior to this time, there are Christians in Egypt and all the way across North Africa, and I'll say more about this later, and maybe to India and up into Asia, into China, and they have the gospel in common. They don't have a creed. They have things they believe, but they don't necessarily believe them in exactly the same way, and there hasn't been a strong attempt to standardize. Okay? With decriminalization comes the pressure to get our act together, which this is also a long and complicated history, but I'm just going to give you the date. ...451 for the Council of Chalcedon. That's the one that at which the bishops gathered in Chalcedon, right between Europe and Asia, right in Asia Minor, which has been one of the strongest places of Christianity to this point, try to understand how it is that Jesus is both human and divine. It's not an easy thing to understand, even with all the resources of the Greek philosophical tradition at your disposal. And not all the churches go with the position that becomes the Orthodox position. And that's when, I'll change colors, the Egyptian church, called the Coptic church, and the Christians who are out here called the Nestorians, you could say, fall out of fellowship. And so in the standard fast aerial view that we get in the middle of the 20th century if we're white Protestants in the United States, we now forget about them. Right? And we will have remembered that there was Augustine, and there was Tertullian, and there was Cyprian, and there was Athanasius, who was called the Black Dwarf. But we will have forgotten they were all Africans. Right? We just remember them for their engagement in these enormously heated debates, which are the debates, the solutions to which we recite in the creeds. Okay? Is that making sense? Am I going too fast? I know some of you this is familiar and some maybe less. Okay, so then we shift. We stop thinking about these guys. And Christianity begins to spread this way. Now, if Constantine in 312 was a Christian, we also know that one of his parents, and I just forgot which one, was from the British Isles. And that Christianity had gotten all the way up to the British Isles. And it spread wherever Rome was. But now, if you will, the center of gravity begins to move this way. And if we think about the globalization of Christianity, say, from 500 to 1,000, mostly that's taking place in Europe. And it's moving by a bunch of ways. Some is military. The namesake of the college at which I teach, right? That was pretty much military. That was about 1,000. After the Norwegians were the people of Iceland, they voted that they would all become Christians. In southern Europe earlier, there's an interesting phenomenon of marriages. So a Christian princess is married into another family, and she brings Christianity with her. Christianity travels by the merchant routes, right? So lots of ways that this is happening, but it's mostly going into Europe, and by about 1,000, we'll say Christianity is largely a European phenomenon, and Europe is largely, at least superficially, Christian. And then there's this period Dan was talking about when Christians realize that not only have they forgotten, they don't realize it, I would say, then we remember, not only have we forgotten about Africa, but in the interim, the expansion of Islam has wiped out a lot of Christianity that was in Africa. And there's much scholarly debate about why that happened. What were the internal weaknesses of the church in North Africa that made it vulnerable to being taken over by Islam? But as we've been hearing from Kit earlier and last week from Dan, Islam is also growing. So Spain and Eastern Europe and Europeans then began to look, for various reasons, back down here. So we have the period of the Crusades. And European Christians become aware again, more fully aware of these Christians down here. They don't always get along so well. So then we put this date, 1054, is when the remnants of the eastern and western part of the Roman Empire embodied in the church disavow each other. And it's very dramatic. There's this bull of excommunication, and it gets waxed down on the altar in Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. It was a long time brewing. You know, just, we know that. You may decide today's the day to walk out and slam the door, but it didn't just start this morning. Right? And it was that way with those two churches. So then at this point we could say two kinds of Christianity. We have Catholic Christianity, and we have Orthodox. Well, we really should say we have three, because we also have this Coptic and Nestorian. All right. So now we're moving quickly along. We come to the Reformation era, and the unity of the apparent unity of the European church will come apart. But in 1555, Pius of Augsburg continues that idea that church and state go together. It has this rule, this principle, this maxim, whoever is the ruler gets to determine the religion of the region. Okay. In the meantime, Istanbul has fallen. Well, Constantinople has fallen, and then it becomes Istanbul. So the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church, declines even more. Okay. Now, some would say, I'm mixing together two parts here, that when we look at the spread of Christianity, to describe it, we can talk about pre-colonial, colonial, and post-colonial spread. I pretty much ignored the details of the pre-colonial, because if we're Christians living here, this is our center of the world. Well, we forgot about the Copts, and we forgot about the Nestorians, and now we've forgotten about the Orthodox. And if we're Protestants who who bring Christianity around the globe by migration, we're likely to forget about the Roman Catholics in Europe too, right? And we're likely to tell the story of Christianity in the United States, starting with the Puritans and their spiritual descendants. Now, when we look at these facts, however, about where Christians are, and we look at these facts that are now much more visible to us, about 33% of the people in the world are Christian, 21% Islam, 14% Hindu, Buddhism and Chinese traditional together, about 12%, Judaism less than 1%. And we think about how Christians are all around the world, and we understand what's happening with the decline of the West anyway, and we understand something about we call it the disestablishment of religion in the United States, that even in the U.S. and even in Europe, where there was that long history of Christianity having political and cultural clout, we don't. It's declining. There's a great debate about what do you mean if you say the United States is a Christian nation? How could that possibly make sense in the present? Historically, you can make sense of it. What does it mean in the present? Oh, yeah, it's in our laws in certain ways. But how is it viable going forward? Then we begin to see this with different eyes. And we see the past with different eyes, not just the present. And we begin to ask ourselves, well, those Christians in Egypt who kept being Christian, who retained the language Copt, the word Coptic, and the word Egyptian. Egyptians will go on for hours and hours about this, trying to explain how those go together. But the point seems to be that the Copts are the closest thing. Their language is the closest to Pharaonic Egyptian that anybody can find. Right? And they will tell you all the things that Christianity absorbed from Pharaonic Egyptian religion.
Pharaonic?
From the pharaohs. From the pharaohs. And they've endured for centuries, always as the minority, always on the outside. Is it time to go?
No.
What can we learn from them? Right? What can we learn from them about how to read the Bible? What can we learn from them about worship? What can we learn from them about how to live with people of other faiths? What can we learn from the Christians in India? Their tradition is that if St. Mark founded the church in Alexandria and Peter and Paul founded the church at Rome, that their church was founded by St. Thomas. People used to think this was ridiculous. How could that possibly be? But recent archaeological evidence has turned up Roman coins of the right era on the coast of India, right? So they got there somehow, maybe they came in the 1500s, but it seems more likely that they came in the first century, that there were trade routes. We know that there is a lot of trade going on along the Silk Routes. And Christianity often traveled with those merchants, not by clergy, not by organized efforts, but because they were Christians and they told each other stories. We find evidence from about the 8th century in China. There's this monument, it's called the Nestorian Monument, and it doesn't have a lot, but it has enough to be clear that in the 8th century there were Nestorian Christians in China. When we were mostly concerned about religious doctrine, we could write them off and say, well, they were Nestorians. They didn't really understand how Jesus was both human and divine. They were heretics. We don't care about them. Now we're more and more interested in, well, how did they get there? And how were they making their case in a Buddhist, Taoist, Confucian culture during the Tang Dynasty when they made those beautiful horses, right? How were they doing that? So we become more and more interested in these things. So let me make some theological assertions about this. What's going on? Christianity makes, first of all, a universal invitation to all people. Right? From the beginning, the heart of Christianity has been God loves all people. Jesus is for all people. Paul and Peter and the early church were fighting that out, how Jesus came not just to the Jews, but also to the Gentiles. We make this universal invitation. I've chosen the word invitation very, very carefully, because by 500 or 600, when European Christianity is alive with imperial power, it starts to sound less like an invitation and more like a requirement. Everybody come, y'all come, sounds less like a party and more like a forced march. But it's still there. And that's one of the things we have to struggle with in the 21st century when we talk about Christianity as global and an aspiration to be a global church. How does the church make that invitation in a way that's invitational? How does the church make that invitation when it doesn't have political power behind it? When it doesn't have cultural influence? Dan's talking about exiles. That's really important. How do you invite people to something if you have no material, if you're not going to give any goodie bags to take home, right? What is it we're going to offer? Maybe it forces us back to what's at the heart of Christianity. Now, it's a universal invitation to follow Jesus. There's content. It's a particular party, right? It's not just any party. It's following Jesus, who is God incarnate in a particular place for a limited time. So we have this strange tension between universal invitation and what we call the scandal of particularity. Right? It's this Jesus, this one, who was in this place, in this time, who the Gospels give witness to. And that's the dance that's always there because of the incarnation. So then we have these two words that are clearly linked. We talk about the incarnation of Jesus, how God takes on human flesh, and then we're interested in the church in enculturation. So some people have begun to talk about Christianity then as a translation movement. It's a translation movement. The task of Christianity is always, how do I speak this message in a way that someone else can hear it and then articulate it in their own language? Right? So it's not just translation in my being able to say it to you so you understand, but there's another step which is involved in enculturation, which is, how do you speak it in your language? The difficulty with using this as a translation movement is it tends to make us think that it's a linguistic task only. It's not strictly a linguistic task. David Morgan, in his work on visual culture, does a nice typology about images. What kind of images are used in North America and Europe to stir up missionary impulse, right? What kind of images do the missionaries use to carry their message? How do the recipients respond? Sometimes rejecting, sometimes working against, sometimes transforming those images so that a conversation goes on visually, linguistically, in terms of customs, and so forth. So as we look at these differences, one of the things we're always asking, we ask things like, well, what makes Chinese Christianity Chinese? What makes Indian Christianity Indian? What makes it Korean or Egyptian or American? Right? What are the things American Christians assume that don't make sense somewhere else? And then why are we interested? And I think this is really important because Americans tend to have, I call it infatuation with novelty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we love other people's music, other people's food, other people's clothes, right? Salem students all come home from India, the women almost all come home from India with a sari. Now, what are they going to do with those saris? I always wonder, what are you going to do with them? I bought these because I knew I would wear them. But is that just in fact, doesn't make me into an Indian if I wear this, even if I had on the pink salwar that goes with it? It doesn't make me an Indian if I eat with my hand. Right? But there's something in common. So this, from my point of view, what's interesting about globalized Christianity is how it helps us understand what's at the heart of the gospel. Right? What is it? What is the treasure we have in common? It helps us to see what's our idiom? What's our dialect? When is that enhancing and when is it a barrier? And sometimes we borrow things. And to understand what is a responsible borrowing is not an easy task. So let me just pause for a minute and see if you want to say things before I go on and talk about some specific examples. I was going to talk a little more about colonial efforts, but I don't have to do that.
I think we can ask the same question that you're asking me around the world, even within Christianity in the United States.
Yep.
I can feel more of an exile in a faith chapel, evangelical mega church, than I do in a Catholic church in some faraway place.
Right. And then we have to ask ourselves, is that just uncomfortable? And it's uncomfortable to be in a church where you don't understand the language, right? But being uncomfortable doesn't necessarily mean that the other people are unfaithful, right? So on Sunday, I don't know how many of you were here on Sunday when we had rock music for the Eucharist. That's a form of enculturation. Is it simply a matter of taste? If some people go, couldn't we Bach? Why are we having this? Or are there theological reasons why we choose one music over another? And this is a very interesting question in India, where in the effort to enculturate, the first wave of enculturation used always Sanskrit, right? And classical Indian dance. Since Indian independence and an increasing self-awareness among a group that calls itself Dalit, there's been a lot of reaction that if Christians are going to use Sanskrit and Sanskrit traditions of music and dance, etc., to indigenize or enculturate Christianity, they're reinforcing the caste system. Because that's high culture. Mm-hmm. And the Dalits, the word Dalit means crushed. It's what you do to lentils, right? When you crush them, that has to do with Dalit. They take that name for themselves rather than being called the scheduled castes, which is the constitutional language for what was called the untouchables. Whose music? Whose culture are we using when we try to speak the local language? Now, I'm not saying that you're only making a matter of taste when you respond to the big church, but somehow it helps me think about our worship wars to know that question in India. Whose tradition are you using for your idiom? And this is very interesting. I was in India only 5 weeks, so I don't have expert view, but I have But I have worship bulletins. Okay? So, the Mar Thoma Syrian Church of Bangalore doesn't use Sanskrit. It doesn't use Hindi. It doesn't use English. Those are the national languages. It uses a local native language. Right? My group appeared there. We had been arranged on our behalf that we would come to a, I think it was a 10 o'clock English service. Well, it turned out it was a 9 o'clock service, not in English. Welcome to India. And they changed it because it was the Metropolitan's 90th birthday. And so we couldn't get anywhere near the church because it was a little church. And there were these gorgeous awnings, just like the Ramadan awnings in Cairo, everywhere. And those plastic resin chairs that are all over the world. So I mean, just get all the globalization pieces here, right? Right? You have the awnings like in Egypt, the resin chairs like in my backyard, a language nobody understands. And because not everyone can get in the church, they have this big projection screen. So you can see what's going on inside the church. And my students and I were just thinking, we don't know what's going on, we don't understand. But they have a bulletin. And you can read the bulletin and you can see what the readings are for Sunday. And you can see when there's a youth sports event and Sunday school camp. And the Christmas Day service is already listed. It was in October.
English?
Yeah, it's all in, this is in English. And the prayer meetings and the Bible study and everybody's birthdays. Right? Whose birthday is coming up and what their phone numbers are. Right? So, you know, it's seeming kind of familiar. We're reading that. We're passing the Bible down the row because the readings are listed. So, you know, when folks enjoy your Bible. Well, fortunately, I did. And then we pass the Bible down, we're reading it. And then, so the guy who was in charge of the church is he's so embarrassed that this has happened, and he didn't want it to happen. So he comes to our guy and says, who's a Lutheran candidate for ordination, and says, well, when this is over, then we'll have a special confession so that they can come to communion. And I'm thinking, when what is over? Which part is over? I don't understand. And not all our group was Christian. Not all our group was going to want to commune. They've already had this weird experience in Athens. So let me just back up. I'm going to give a bunch of communion stories. So in Athens, our guide has arranged for us to go to a suburban Athens Orthodox church. And we're late. Well, we're not really late. We're just late if you're Americans. Because the Greeks don't care if you're late or not. If you're there in time for the distribution, that's fine. And the old ladies are there at the beginning, but not everybody there is. So we come in, and they save like the 30 best seats. So we have to walk in late, and we sit down. And because we were coming, all the city council was there. Because 98% of the people in Greece are Greek Orthodox. And so, of course, all the city council is Greek Orthodox, so they're all there. And they chanted the gospel in English because we were there, which is incredible. And then it comes to the distribution, and this guy comes with this big basket of bread, and he starts passing it down the rows. And those of us who knew anything are like, ah! And the deacon goes, no, it's not communion. It's just blessed bread. And then the students who didn't know anything are like, well, why aren't they giving us the real thing? Okay, so now we're in Bangalore, and I'm trying to when what is over? What are they going to do? Well, it was when the distribution was over. Then we had to remember to take off our shoes when we went into the church. And then we got up there, and we kneeled down, and they did for us in English kind of the SBH confession. You know, I confess that I'm in bondage to sin and cannot free myself. I mean, it was real serious. And then they communed us. So one of the things we learned as we were going around the world is how these these boundaries are permeable or not permeable.
Okay, so that was one.
Then we went to the Memorial Church of Whitefield. And when the students wrote about it, they noticed, among other things, that the organ player was really bad, but it was nice to have hymns they recognized. That hardly anyone was wearing Indian dress. Now, does that mean that the Whitefield Church has sold out because people weren't wearing Indian dress? Were they wearing, then you have to ask the question, were they wearing Indian dress when they went to work? When they went to the grocery store? When they went to the movies? But not when they went to church. In contrast to that, we went to the National Baptismal Catechetical Liturgical Center in Bangalore, which is a Roman Catholic place, and participated in an Indian rite. They have these 12 points of adaptation. And here's one of the places I really struggle with is Sanskrit, Dalit, how does this work? But they've made and had approved by the Vatican some very clear changes in their effort to enculturate, to both be in continuity with the Roman Catholic Church, which came in the 1500s. So we have the St. Thomas Christians, we have the Catholics coming in the 15th century, and then starting in 1706 with the Royal Danish Mission staffed by Germans, Protestants. Okay. For example, in the Indian rite, what do? They have, the priest wears orange. What is the liturgical meaning of the color orange? Danger. We think orange for us is like danger, caution. But in Indian culture, orange is the auspicious color, right? Orange is the color of good fortune. And so the priest wears orange. Everyone takes off their shoes when they come in. You sit on the floor. You're welcomed with perfumed paste. Right? They're singing in Sanskrit. There's dancing in the Indian classical forms. And there's one of the issues here is always what's Hindu and what's Indian. Right? What's Hindu and what's Indian? So there's a thing that happens with flowers, incense, and flame on a tray. Called arati. It's a kind of honoring. And in this Indian rite, they do it four times. First, when the priest comes, you honor God's presence in the priest. The priest takes it and does it to the congregation, over the scripture before the scripture is read, and over the elements. Now, what are we to make of that? Is that like rock music? Well, not exactly. It might be religious. Is it Hindu? Are those Catholics stealing something from the Hindus? Are they making their worship Hindu? These are not easy questions to answer. And I was really interested in students' response to this and also to what the priest said, because by this time I know to ask him about communion. So in the lecture, I raised my hand, Father Thomas, when it comes time to the distribution, what instructions would you give us? And he gave us the straight Roman Catholic line, and then he goes, but I don't know which of you are Roman Catholic. And some American students were like, wow, the Indians are really open, not knowing that you could find that in many progressive Roman Catholic churches in the United States. Then I'll tell you one more India story, which is from Revisiting Protestant Reformation, Seeking Its Relevance for the Church Today, Bangalore Lutheran Get Together. The women's organization sang. There was a men's quartet. They didn't have an organ. They had 24 violins and a drum. And that's the standard music for Lutheran churches in India. And the youth group had these silver lame things, and they did a kind of half Bollywood, half classical interpretive dance to A Mighty Fortress Is Our Guide. We had A Mighty Fortress 3 times. We had very familiar hymns translated into the local languages so that they no longer fit the tune. So when we say the church is globalized, we're saying it's going around the globe and it's changing and growing. The Church of India, the Lutheran Church of India, is not part of the Church of South India. The Church of South India is one of the first ecumenically constituted churches of the 20th century. So one of the things that was imported from North America, denominations. It seems to me one of the things North American Christians learned from the church around the world is a kind of ecumenism that tries to find out what are the really important things that we have in common, and do they unite us across things we don't have in common? And this is stapled wrong, so it's hard to find. I just want to read you a little bit from their governing principles. The Church of South India accepts the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament as containing all things necessary for salvation, and as the supreme and decisive standard of faith, semicolon, and, it should say but, acknowledges that the church must always be ready to correct and reform itself in accordance with the teaching of those scriptures as the Holy Spirit shall reveal it. It also accepts the Apostles' Creed and the Creed commonly called the Nicene as witnessing to and safeguarding that faith, and it faithfully acknowledges that same faith to be continuously confirmed by the Holy Spirit in the experience of the Church of Christ. The churches of the South are much more open to the Spirit. And frankly, it wouldn't be hard, because Christianity, as it developed from the Mediterranean into Europe and into North America, was really concerned about the first and second persons of the Trinity, but not so much about the third. So I think that's another thing we learned from them. We learned about ecumenism, we learned about the Spirit, and then a third thing I would say, and then I'll stop, is about how to live well with people of other faiths. These Christians in these places, Korea has a huge Christian population. 25% of South Korea is Christian. That's huge if you're not in Europe or North America or probably South America. It's huge. It's still only 25%, right? And how this works changes from place to place. That's, I guess, the other thing I want to emphasize, is when we talk about Christianity around the world, we can't say that the Copts and the Namibians and the Chinese and the Indians are all the same. Their history is different and their contemporary situation is different. In Korea, Christianity came first through Beijing. There were Korean diplomats, if you will, who were in Beijing because they were in the Chinese imperial arena. And in Beijing, they met Catholics and they were interested in that Chinese Catholicism, and they brought it home. And then in the 1800s was when Presbyterian missionaries started to come there. And when the Koreans entered a period of Japanese imperialism, Christians were anti-imperialist. So how Christianity looks to Koreans is very different than how Christianity looks to Indians, where Christianity came with first the Portuguese, and then with the British. It's a very different political and cultural impact. Also, this is the very last thing I promise, is the difference between how Buddhism and Confucianism respond to Christianity and how Hinduism responds to Christianity is significant as we try and figure out how to live in interfaith contexts. The Chinese-Korean response in interfaith families is you kind of do what's right for that life cycle moment, right? And so it's not competition. It's for these things. Well, Christians do great weddings. So for weddings, we want Christianity, right? And for other things, we want Buddhism. For other things, we want Taoism. And, you know, that's fine. Hinduism tends to absorb. Oh, yeah, fine. Okay, well, Jesus, why not? Good. Jesus is a bodhisattva or an avatar or a sage. We have room for that. So what we learn about living with people of other faiths is to pay attention to what those faiths are. Right? The relationship between the Copts and the Muslims in Egypt is very different than the relationship between Christians and Hindus in India. Nonetheless, I think we can learn from all of them, especially as American Christians who have less political power, less cultural influence, more pluralism around us. As we're trying to understand at this point, I think probably to think about globalized Christianity for us is less about what we can give and more about what we can learn. So, that's a beginning. And tons of books are coming out. Lots of people are really interested in this, but I think we need to pay attention to the big picture and then concentrate on specific cases is how we'll really learn them. So,
thank you.
Any responses? Thank you all. Chris.
Well, I'm curious about the development of broader senses of Christianity, and that relates to how mobile people were and how mobile their perceptions were and how many people at different eras were mobile.
Yeah.
Because I think how we understand that now is so dramatically different, and I don't really know if there's a story that's globally in terms of a movement towards globalization.
Yeah.
Probably more pockets of...
Right. Right, and I think that's absolutely the case. So that in the pre-colonial period, when there's this effort to standardize, once you get to the empire, we know that variety continued in specific places. In later times, like in the Protestant missionary movement, part of the reason the Protestant missionary movement could happen, steamships, right? That was important. Cheap printing, right? All of those things contribute. And so then there gets to be a broader knowledge. Today it's much more. And so one of the things that I know is going on all over the United States and American churches is efforts not just to build institutional bridges, but for people to go across them.
Yeah.
Right? And this is one of the things that I've become sort of, I say it all the time, institutions build bridges, people go across them. And so, you know, the Hansons who were in Slovakia for 7 years, they probably couldn't have done that if there hadn't been a partnership between institutions. But the real relationship and the real learning happens when people go across them. And how do we go across them? Well, you know, so I can tell some, many of you know this, but half of the summer offering from Holden is going to this home for women in India. Why is that? Well, because 40 years ago, when Sales started its global semester, Jane and Doug Koons went on that, and it transformed their view of the world. And when they took early retirement, they went with Lutheran Partners in Global Mission to Tamil Nadu to work in this set of social service projects that the Arcot Lutheran Church has. And because they were there, the St. Olaf Global Semester now goes there. And since I was there and I saw the weaving workshop and I knew Holden, I thought, what a great summer offering. Right? And it's those stories that make the church, maybe that's when we stop talking about the church as global and talk about ecumenism as being in one household. The church is ecumenical. We are all in one household. But it's a big household.
Yeah.
I don't know if that addressed. There's certainly in that, particularly in that colonial period, there's lots of portraying the church around the world as exotic. And that's part of moving to the post-colonial period, is not to say, oh, you know, the Christians in India, they're so poor but so faithful. That's really not enough. And it's rather to say, you know, the Christians in India are working really hard to understand what it means to be a Christian in a culture shaped by Hinduism, how to be faithful in a culture that's still pervaded by cult, by caste, in all kinds of ways. Who is your audience? What music do you use? You heard Elsa Marty tell this great story about getting to India. She's a vegetarian. She's been a vegetarian for years for moral, ethical reasons. She gets to India, and the people where she's studying say, why aren't you eating meat? If you want to identify with a lower caste, you should eat meat. Because that's how one of the, and we visited Dalits who are not Christian. And the students asked them about, you know, well, what if a Brahmin wanted to join your movement, you know, wanted to be with you? Well, would you have any tests? And they said, we would expect them to eat meat. Right? That would be a sign that they really cut through all that deep mythology about levels. Right? So, those are the, yeah, of course, a lot of Christians in India are poor. You know what? A lot of Christians in the United States are poor. And that's interesting and important, but it's not the only interesting and important thing. How do Indians, Christians in India who have money, respond to Indians and Christians in India who don't have money? That's interesting. And the Arcot Lutheran Church has, it can just puff you up to hear about the Arcot Lutheran Church, because they were anti-caste from the beginning. This missionary came, he was anti-caste, his sending agency wouldn't support him, he said, okay, fine, go away. And then he bought, somehow he got money, and he bought this plot of land, and he offered it free to anyone who wanted to live there. There's a period of arranged marriage. If you will marry your children against caste, you can live here. And that was the beginning of that church. They have 100 schools for Sri Lankans who have had to move there, who have no money. They're working with a whole community of people who are transgendered. You know, they're doing amazing things, including having built an interfaith dialogue center in one of the major Hindu pilgrimage towns. In part because Joshua Peter, who is the pastor in that town, grew up in that town, is good friends with the Brahmin priest of that temple. So we were taken in. I mean, this is the other side that's hard, you know. We're taken in. The guidebook says, if you're not a Hindu, you can't come in this temple. And so we take off our shoes, and they take us all around in front of all these people who are waiting in line. And then we go in, and the priest gives us this blessing, and we're all like, what is this? It's the opposite of, what do you mean it's not the real bread? Like, what are you doing? What is this you're doing? Am I supposed to be doing this or not? So I think we can learn from Christians around the world to be a little more flexible and open to the Spirit. I'm sorry, that was a long answer to a short question. But so thank you.
Yes.
Dinner.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, bizarre.